we are off to the races here. We've got really a really great turnout here for Saturday morning so far. We plan to be with you here for the next couple of hours with live music. We'll be chatting with a number of the artists and a number of folks from around the East Lansing scene. We'll be talking food. Well, food and music, I think, are really dominating the next couple of hours, along with, of course, a lot of visual art as well. So we hope you can stay close until 1 o'clock today from the East Lansing Art Festival. I'm Mark Bayshore. For many artists here at the East Lansing Art Festival, events like this are a large part of their livelihood. However, making your way into the art festival circuit can be a daunting task for a new artist. That's why each year the East Lansing Art Festival provides up-and-coming artists the opportunity to exhibit their work for the first time at a top fine arts festival. Now, the festival's Emerging Artist Program is a life and career-changing experience for many who participate. Painter Katie Mester was part of the Emerging Artist Program a couple of years ago. Today, Katie spends a lot of her time on the festival circuit, and she joins us to talk to us now about making the art festival rounds. Katie, nice to meet you.
Hi, thank you.
You graduated from Central Michigan University in 2010, and you wanted to work professionally as an artist. What's your medium?
I do oil paintings.
You're an oil painter.
Yes.
No other kind of painting? You specialize in oils?
I specialize in oils, yes.
How did you first end up hearing about the Emerging Artist Program here at the ELAF?
I guess, my senior year at Central Michigan University, I was getting my bachelor's degree in fine art, and strolling the hall, I saw a poster for it on a board in the hallway of the art department, and I thought, hey, I should give that a shot. And I applied, and I was accepted into the as one of five emerging artists, and I'd never even been to an art show before, so I really didn't know what to expect.
Oh,
and I
jumped
had to
in
Google.
Over your head.
Yeah, I did. I had to Google art shows, like what I was getting into. And I got in touch with a friend that I knew had done them and found out kind of what to expect, and just kind of hit the ground running, and it was so well received. It was a real blessing. And
so that was what year?
That was 2010.
That was 2010.
Yeah.
Okay.
Four years ago.
You had graduated.
Yeah, it was the same year I was graduating that I had to.
What do you remember from that first show then? Was it what you expected?
I think it was beyond what I had expected. It was.
Is that a good thing or
yes,
a bad thing?
It was a great thing. There was just tons of people enjoyed my artwork so much that I just found myself exposed to a whole new crowd of people, and it was really well received, and it was really God was opening this door, and now here I am, year number four, and I'm one of the vendors
That's really fantastic. I mean, how has getting deeper into the art festival circuit changed your career?
Well, now, because of the art festivals, I do them throughout the state in the summer, and I'm also in four galleries, and the only way that I came across those galleries was because they saw my work at festivals, and I've developed a large following of people who have been collecting my art now. And that's been because of the shows as well, because it's brought so many people to me.
Have you started getting commissions?
Oh, yes.
Oh.
Yes, I do commissions year-round, and besides the four galleries this year, I'm doing seven shows, but I'm only doing a few less shows. I had a baby, my first baby in October, so I had to kind of cut back.
This has been a productive experience for you. I'm really interested.
Yeah.
Beyond selling art directly, how else does an art festival like East Lansing's help build connections?
Well, the fact that they do the Emerging Artist Program is just great to keep this kind of thing alive, because for younger people to start out doing art shows, there's so much involvement and so much expense to get started. The fact that they offer a free shot at just trying something like this out, I mean, your booth fee is covered, they provide the setup. It really makes it easy for you to just bring your own work and show it to people without having to worry about covering cost.
We are talking with oil painter Katie Mester. Katie is a Michigan-based oil painter. and a former emerging artist here at the East Lansing Art Festival, where Current State is broadcasting live here on Saturday morning on 90.5 WKAR. I'm really curious, when you talk with your former classmates from Central Michigan University, do you guys stay in touch with each other, and do you kind of keep track of how you're doing in your careers?
Yeah, a few here and there, ones that I was close with.
Have you been able to, share with them what the experience has been like here at the East Lansing Art Festival?
Yeah. I seem to kind of be one of the few that went this route. I'm not really sure if I think I'm. This is kind of unique for me, for Central. I don't know if this is something they really promote, doing the art shows or what, because I hadn't found this opportunity. It just happened on a whim for me. But different people I've met through the Emerging Artist Program, they were from other schools, and they've really found it to be really successful for them as well.
Have these shows helped to help you to live solely off your art?
Yes. And that seems like a really unique thing, especially in this day and age with the economy. But I've just found myself to be really blessed. And these art shows are really, it is possible to do what you love and make a living at it. So
tell us a little bit more about what you paint exactly. You've told us you're an oil painter.
Well, I'm from Clare, and my parents, I grew up on a farm up there, and a lot of my work reflects the farm life surrounding rural areas, a lot of sheep and cattle, horses, also landscapes. I do shows up north, so some of my landscapes turn into more water and bay scenes, but a lot of natural.
And you said you've got 7 shows planned?
I do.
Is that
yes.
right? And how far afield? Are those all in Michigan or where?
They're all in Michigan. I have yet to venture out of the state, but being located in Clare, it makes it easy to do a show in Birmingham, just as easy as to do a show in Petoskey or Traverse City, which is where I'll be later this year. So,
do you think that other young artists like yourself are aware that art festivals like East Lansing's can become a viable way to make a living?
Well, I'm not sure. I don't think so, but this Emerging Artist Program really, really helps, really is really helping keeping a young crop of artists in these festivals.
And are you how much young participation in these festivals do you notice?
Not many.
You are?
I'm kind of one of the few, but they're showing up here and there.
Okay. Very good. Well, it's been really interesting to talk with you. We're encouraged by all of your success and all of the help that you receive from our hometown art festival.
Yes.
Katie Mester is a Michigan-based oil painter and a former emerging artist here at the East Lansing Art Festival. Today, she travels to shows throughout the state. Good luck, Katie.
Thank you.
It's Current State here on 90.5 WKAR, live from the East Lansing Art Festival in downtown East Lansing. The East Lansing Art Festival is one of hundreds of seasonal outdoor art festivals across the country. They take place year-round if you're far enough south. Nate Shelton covers the scene as the editor of Sunshine Artist Magazine, based in Orlando, Florida. Sunshine Artist bills itself as America's premier art and craft show magazine. It's been in publication since 1972. The East Lansing Art Festival made the publication's annual 200 Best list last September, and I asked Mr. Shelton how the 200 Best are selected.
Well, the 200 Best is our readers' annual ranking of the 200 shows that they find to be the most profitable throughout the United States. It's broken down into two lists. One list focuses 100 of the top 100 fine art shows in the country, whereas the second is the top 100 craft shows in the country, being contemporary and classic crafts. The way that it's selected is every April we include a ballot with our issue that goes out to the subscribers, and they're simply asked to put down the 10 shows that they found to be the most profitable over the past year. For example, with the 2014 ballots that just went out this past April, they were actually ranking shows that they attended in 2013. So when the next list comes out in our September issue, it'll be ranking the shows from 2013 that, again, our readers found to be the most profitable. A common misperception with the 200 best is that it's something that we put together independently, or that it's somehow based on how nice the show was or how well artists were treated by the management. But it really just comes down to the dollars and cents, how much they actually earned at those shows.
Now, East Lansing made the 200 best list in the fine art and design division. What puts East Lansing's event in that division and not the other one?
Well, when they're filling out their ballots, the readers are asked to indicate whether or not they consider themselves to be a craftsperson or an artist. And once we tally up the votes, if a show's votes primarily came from artists who identify as craftspeople, that show will wind up on our craft list. However, if they primarily identify as fine artists, then it winds up on the fine art list. So in the case of East Lansing, a majority of the people who voted for it and indicated that they had a good profitable show there identified as fine artists.
Okay. How many Michigan shows in total made the 2013 200 best list?
You guys had 13. You had 10 in the fine art portion and 3 in the craft portion.
What were a couple of the others? I imagine the Ann Arbor Art Festival made the list.
Yeah, several of the Ann Arbor festivals actually made the list. An interesting thing about the Ann Arbor shows is even though that they all take place on the same weekend, each of them is considered a separate event is what it
comes
down to.
How many years have you been doing the rankings?
The rankings have now been going on 21 years. This will be our 22nd list coming out in September 2014.
Hmm. Current State talking with Nate Shelton, editor of Sunshine Artist Magazine, which recently ranked the East Lansing Art Festival on its 200 best list. Nate, remind our listeners what it means when an event is billed as juried, like the East Lansing Art Festival.
Essentially what that means is that the promoters or the organizers of the show will bring in a small jury of people in the arts community, whether they be other artists, whether they be other show promoters, gallery owners, or what have you, and they will review every submission that comes in from an artist who wants to be accepted into that show. After viewing all of the submissions, they'll go ahead and narrow it down to the exact number that they're looking for. Some shows are looking for 75 artists, some are looking for 500 artists.
Mm-hmm.
If a show is not juried, that generally means that either the management is selecting the artists themselves, or in some cases it's just the first come, first served.
I have to ask you this. How many people attend a summer art festival with the express purpose of purchasing something as opposed to just looking at art, people watching, and so on? Do you have a feel for that?
To be honest with you, your guess would be as good as mine. I mean, shows can attract anywhere from 1,000 to 500,000 people. But as far as the individual percentage of people that are actually making a purchase, the only way really to get that would be to check with the promoter of a specific show, and generally they play their cards pretty close to their chest.
Boy, there's an art show that draws 500,000 people, literally?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think that would be more along the lines of a craft show. Something like Sunfest, for example, over in Maryland, they can easily attract upwards to 500,000 people over the four-day weekend. A lot of that has to do with the tourists coming into the area as well, of course.
You've written about a practice called buy-sell and how it hurts the art and craft show industry. What is buy-sell?
Buy-sell is pretty much what it sounds like. It happens when rather unscrupulous vendors will go ahead and purchase low-cost crafts or art from overseas and just basically pass it off as their own work. That hurts the artist tremendously because, of course, true artists and true craftspeople spend several months, probably most of the year, working on new creations to sell. And, of course, they can't beat those rock-bottom prices that a buy-sell vendor is going to be able to offer on something that they bought, 5 cents a head or what have you. So, ultimately, it hurts the artists, and the more artists that get hurt and can't make a living off the industry anymore, the more and more of this buy-sell that you're going to see, and the more and more people are going to be turned off from wanting to go to an art show. Because, frankly, who wants to walk around all day in the sun after just looking at merchandise that they could have just as easily bought at Walmart for themselves?
Very good. Nate Shelton is the editor of Sunshine Artist Magazine. Sunshine Artist recently ranked the East Lansing Art Festival as one of its 200 best. Thank you, Nate.
No problem, Mark. Glad to speak with you.
Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. The music you can probably make out in the background is coming from one of the music stages here at the Art Festival, and I'm 90% certain that we've got the East Lansing High School Jazz Ensemble up there performing. I'm getting nods from some of the people as I say that. So the East Lansing jazz ensemble performing live. I'm Mark Bayshore. We'll be here live until 1 o'clock. We are positioned right in front of East Lansing City Hall, and we encourage you to stop by, say hi, tell us what you make of our program, make suggestions. Now is the time to do it. We would love to have a chance to meet you. If you've ever been to an East Lansing Art Festival, you've probably seen someone walk by carrying a large copper fish that they just purchased for their yard. That would most likely be the work of Midland, Michigan artist Jim Artis. He's been an exhibitor here at the East Lansing Festival on and off for the better part of 25 years. Jim shared some thoughts on art, the price of copper, and life on the festival circuit with Current State's Melissa Benmark.
Describe your style of artwork for our listeners.
Well, yes, I'd be happy to. I make copper art using roofing copper, and I use a technique called repoussé, which just means hammering from both front and back. I enjoy doing wildlife. I have some figurative repoussé. But I started out with copper in combination with clay quite a while ago, and I needed to make some hair for a lady's head that I had, and I found an old sewer pipe and cut it apart and flattened it and used it, and then I progressed to buying new copper. And I hammer out suns and moons and fish. I'm really attracted to fish. I'm not a fisherman, but they're nature's rockets, and I just love them. They're very fast and sleek, and I make six-foot trout and bass, and I've made exotic fish like a bearded fish, and that's kind of what I'm into now.
It sounds like you've worked in found materials as well as bought materials. Has the price of copper going up recently put you in a position of maybe moving on to some other materials just because it got real expensive?
No, but I did throw myself into a corner and cry a bit when it went from, I used to buy 40 sheets of copper for $1,400, and now it's $5,000.
Ooh.
And I've often wished I'd have sold my house and bought copper back then, but I still use it. It's a new gold. I can't get rid of it.
How long have you been in the art business, and have you had to have a day job to support your art, or have you been able to make a living through your art?
Yes, I did have a day job. Believe it or not, I worked a desk job for a number of years, and I worked with teachers a lot and kind of got the notion that I would like to be a teacher. So I started there and got a degree in teaching from CMU in secondary art, and went into teaching at Delta College in the Saginaw Midland area, and also I taught pottery at Midland Center for the Arts for about 3 years, and that was in the middle 70s. And I immediately found out that it was taking up too much time, and I just wanted to do art. So I quit those jobs and started in the art fair biz in 1978, and I've been in it ever since. It's been a labor of love, and it's been up and down like a yo-yo, but heck, what job is it?
Describe sort of I suppose there must be kind of a yearly cycle for someone who does the art festival
circuit.
Oh,
yes, yes.
So how does that work?
Called, on one hand, it's called poverty. On the other hand, it's called wealth. That's the cycle. Actually, no, it's not like that. I do art fairs from May to September. That's been the normal route for me. And now I've just added February shows in Florida. This year was my first year. We did three shows in the state of Florida and did quite well. So, but the cycle is, yes, when the art fairs begin here in Michigan in the May, they carry through until about September. And then the Christmas shows, which I don't do much of, now I'll be going to Florida. It's just too nice not to, especially in the winter.
Overall, what is the hardest thing about doing the art festival circuit, do you think?
Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, I think I work in comparative isolation on a river in my studio, and I don't see people hardly at all. And so one of the great points of art fairs, I go out and get to interact with the public, and so sometimes it's hundreds of thousands of people. And I really can get an idea of whether or not my newest artwork is worthy of the market or not. I really enjoy that. It's a great sounding board for where my art is going. And I think the hardest part of it, of course, is the labor of setting up and tearing down. And then the emotionally charged part would be not making what you thought you were going to make. It's I've learned not to have expectations. I might do quite well at a show 1 year, and the next year fail miserably at that same show. And all of us artists try to figure out why that is. And I try to own that. It's my responsibility to do new work every year. And I know that if I do that, I'll have success.
Is there something unique about the East Lansing Art Festival over the years that for you sets it apart from the other festivals that you go to regularly?
Well, you know, it's a university town. I love that. A lot of young people. And I graduated from MSU in the early 70s, and two of my children have graduated from MSU, so I'm quite familiar with the city, and I love it. I think the art fair is laid out quite nicely. It's a lot of good places to eat and enjoy the city, and it's easy to get around. Some art fairs are very complex, and you're not sure whether you hit all the streets and all the vendors, but here it's laid out so that you can.
So do you go and see other artists' work, too?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Well, you know, I think doing this business, you have you build a friendship base of people that you don't know where they live. You know they live in Wyoming, and they come to this show, or they live in Florida, and they're always at that show. And I know a lot of artists that way, and we've become good friends over the years for 3 days out of the year. Just the other day, I was thinking about the number of friends I have that I don't even know where they're from. I just see them at the shows. The crowd's getting older, too, you know, the artist crowd.
Do you think there's an economic component to people getting into the art business that now it's...
Oh, my goodness, yes. You know, I don't think our schools teach that art is a possibility. That's just a kind of a profession that's not taught in school. Jobs for industry would be the main thrust of most schools. So I think they're surprised when they talk to an artist that some artists make a lot of money at this and do quite well.
Do you have a particular piece this year that you're looking forward to unveiling to the East Lansing crowd?
Well, yes, I have two or three new pieces. They're copper. One is 4 feet in diameter, and it is composed of various types of leaves from trees in Michigan in a circle with stems all coming to a point in the middle. And it's flanked right behind all of that by a copper sun. And it's a new piece for me. I'm excited about it. I fall in love with it every time I see it.
Do you have a little twinge of sadness when you have to let one of them go?
Oh, my. Yes, I do. I do. You know, it depends on how much money you get, unfortunately. Well, it's not really unfortunate. It's the truth. I never know how to price my artwork. And so I try to put a fair price on it. And when I sell it and I see it walking away and I have the money in my hand, I ask myself, do I feel like making another one? Am I excited about it? Or am I sad that it's gone? And if I've done it right, I feel excited about making another one. And I have enough money to do that again and willing to. So, yes, I do. There have been some artists in my past who saved their best work and put it in the attic, and I've just not been able to do that. When I run out of work, my work sells, I come and take work off my walls and stuff that I've treasured or just got out of the kiln and fell in love with. I put it on my living room wall, and the very next week I'm maybe short because I've sold so much. I grab it and off it goes. I can always make it again, I think, but usually it's difficult to duplicate a piece.
So it's kind of a beginning as well as an ending.
It is, indeed. Yes, well said. Yep.
Well, Jim Artis, thank you so much for joining us, and I hope...
Oh, my pleasure.
I hope that the festival is a wonderful experience for you this year, and I know our listeners will be looking forward to seeing your works.
Well, great. Thanks so much for talking with me.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
You're tuned to Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. We are live and on the road today in downtown East Lansing, set up right in front of East Lansing City Hall, where we are mingling with visitors to the East Lansing Art Festival, the 51st annual here in East Lansing. And it's our second year of broadcasting live from the event. We look forward to seeing you. We'll be here broadcasting live until 1 o'clock today. When you walk into Swagath Indian cuisine here in East Lansing, you're greeted by the rich aroma of dishes like tiki masala, pollock paneer, and gobi aloo. Today, the delicious fragrance of Swagath will grace the streets of East Lansing as part of the East Lansing Art Festival. This is their first. This will be their first at the event. Swagath's Shiva Reddy is here to tell us more about his East Lansing restaurant. And I'm told that Swagath in Indian means welcome, so I can officially say Swagath, Shiva.
Yes, thank you.
I didn't mess that up.
No,
Swagath is it. It means welcome. First things first, what is on the menu today that you'd recommend most?
I recommend chicken tikka masala and Navratan kurma. They are both made with tomato sauce and cashew cream, so they're very mild. People can try it without any fear of being it too spicy.
Okay. Swagath's Indian cuisine has been open for a few years now, but the attached grocery store has been opened longer. Tell us why you decided to open the grocery store here in East Lansing.
Well, the grocery store been open since 2002, and we were there from 2005. So we bought it from somebody else. And we developed it really well, and the public wanted to see how we will do in the restaurant arena. So because of the public demand, we opened a restaurant.
You got a pretty loyal clientele?
I have few, mostly from East Lansing area.
Okay.
A lot of college professors, students.
That's quite a transition going from opening a grocery store to a restaurant. I know how tough the restaurant business is. Can be, and you already had one business going. What was it like to add the restaurant?
Well, I mean, the ingredients for the restaurant, I mean, the food that we make, we get it from the grocery store. So it wasn't too hard to transition from the grocery store to the restaurant, because I get the fresh ingredients from my store.
Okay. A family-run business? I mean, other family members help you run?
Mostly it's me and my brother, Siddharth Reddy. We closely work together and try to make it going.
And you don't vacation together?
No vacation.
No, absolutely.
It's been five years since we had a vacation. It's either I leave or he leaves.
Okay.
There's no both of us going.
But you're in each other's shirts running
all
the businesses, so there's no way you're going to be vacationing together. Anything like that. Just like in any country, there are many regional differences that shape food. Is the food served at Swagath influenced by a certain geographical region of India?
Well, I mean, we are in America, so we have to cater to, the whole public. So we do tend to make it, according to the customer's taste. So first thing is, when people walk in, I let my chef know who it is and what and where they're from, and we tend to make food according to the customers.
Now, does that mean preparing food less spicy cuisine than you probably would if you were actually in India?
So basically, South India is the more spicy cuisine. And we tend to make most of the food North Indian with a lot of cream-based, a lot of butter.
Okay. We're talking with Shiva Reddy of Swagath Indian Cuisine and Grocery in downtown East Lansing. The restaurant and store are located, well, they're in the Trowbridge Plaza, actually. I should correct that. What are some of your most popular dishes?
Chicken tikka masala. That's the most favorite amongst all public.
Now, is that just unusually popular in America, or is that as popular in India as
it is in
America? It's not.
It's actually popular in Britain. The British people, or not the British people, but the, you know, in Britain, it became very popular, and then it crossed over to America. So it's mildly, it's sweet, a little bit sweet, not too spicy, and it's got a lot of cream in it. So, you know, it's sugary and creamy. People tend to like that.
You moved to the United States as a child, I understand.
Yes.
How old were you when you moved here?
I was 14.
14, wow.
14 years, yes.
Quite a transitional year, even when you're not moving to the other side of the world.
No.
What was the biggest difference you noticed about food as a 14-year-old when you came to the United States? Was it familiar? Was it totally unfamiliar?
It was unfamiliar, and I didn't seem to get so much variety, you know. And then I had to go to different cuisines to get the variety that I was used to in India. Like in India, mornings we have something, afternoons we have something, night we have something different. So it's not going to be the same food, you know, the whole day. We change a lot. So that's the variety I was looking for. So
Are meal times at different times in India?
No. I mean, they're all set times. I mean, morning, afternoon.
Okay.
You know, nighttime.
What do you make of American food now? I mean, you said that you were struck by the lack of
variety
in American cuisine when you came here. In all those years since you were 14 years old,
what
do you make of it now?
I use a lot of Indian spices to spice the food up, basically.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I eat beef, so I make an Indian beef curry. I make an Indian style pizza.
Do you work both the restaurant and the grocery store?
Yes.
I mean, everybody. There's only two of you really in charge, so I imagine you go back and forth like that.
Yes, I do go back and forth.
Have you found that since you started your restaurant, you've had a more diverse customer base than for your grocery store?
Yes.
Okay.
After opening the restaurant, a lot of people, you know, once they like what we make in the restaurant, they wanted to try making on their own. So they come to the grocery side and ask me for ingredients, how we make and all that.
Is dessert popular in Indian cuisine?
Yes.
Now,
yes.
What kinds of things tends to be served for dessert?
Actually, we are serving right now, it's something called gulab jamun. It's milk-based sweet in sugar syrup. It's a fried milk dessert.
Okay. Now, I imagine, do you consider Swagath a focal point or a gathering place for the Indian community in East Lansing? I would assume that's the case.
It's a gathering point. I mean, you know, we're the ones that have the most variety of products in all this area. So we're a pretty big store for East Lansing. So we have a lot of people coming from Mount Pleasant. We get people from Jackson. We get people from you know, Battle Creek. So all these areas, they don't have a good Indian grocery or an Indian restaurant.
We're talking with Shiva Reddy of Swagath's in East Lansing. They're represented here at the East Lansing Art Festival and serving up some of their cuisine. And you can find them in the Trowbridge Plaza as well. Have you journeyed back to India often since you've moved to the United States?
Yes, I go every 2 years, once in 2 years.
Do you follow the politics or the issues going on? Not at all. Just had an election.
Only business.
Interesting. Oh,
only business. Those politics.
Yeah.
I don't follow much.
Okay. Do you feel closer to Indian culture? Do you feel like you're maintaining a connection with India just through the nature of your business?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I mean, day in and day out, I deal with, you know, Indian population.
Yeah.
So we do conversate a little bit about back home politics. Only small amounts, but not much.
Okay.
Not too serious.
Well, Shiva Reddy, we want to thank you very much for joining us here on Current State. Shiva Reddy of Swagath Indian Cuisine and Grocery, the restaurant and store located in the Trowbridge Plaza. Thank you, Shiva.
Thank you.
It's Current State here on 90.5 WKAR, live from the East Lansing Art Festival. We have got a healthy crowd of patrons and visitors to the East Lansing Art Festival strolling by here at 410 Abbott Road. We hope you can join us between now and 1 o'clock. The Broad Art Museum at Michigan State University has brought new attention to the arts community here in East Lansing. For this year's East Lansing Art Festival, they encouraged a world-renowned artist to extend a project from inside the museum to the streets and sidewalks of the city. Visitors to the Broad can see The God of Small Things by Pakistani artist Imran Qureshi, featuring And They Still Seek the Traces of Blood. That's a piece that's made up of thousands of pieces of crumpled paper. While installing the work, Qureshi agreed to create public art here in the city of East Lansing. Current State Scott Pohl spoke with Broad Art Museum curator Allison Gass.
I want to talk with you about the Broad's role in the festival, and especially getting the artist Imran Qureshi to do some work that will be seen by people when they visit the East Lansing Art Festival. Talk first of all about the Broad's involvement in the festival, why the Broad wants to be involved in the festival.
Sure. Well, we're very committed to the arts festival. We see ourselves as kind of a member of this arts community, a linchpin in some ways to bring new artists here, that artists who already live here and are interested in the arts get to have dialogue with artists from all around the world. So that's important to us. But it's really important to us to not just expect people to come inside the walls of the museum, but rather for us to go out into the world and talk. So we'll be having a booth at the arts festival. Our education team has put together activities and things like that, so we're very much part of it in the way everybody else is, and that's really exciting.
Well, what's really exciting is the installation of Imran Qureshi's work on the streets, on the sidewalks of East Lansing, that a lot of people who haven't been in the city in the last few weeks will see for the first time. Tell me about, first of all, what led you to ask him to do such a thing?
Well, Imran Qureshi is a really extraordinary artist who has risen to great acclaim in the art world over the last several years, really. He's a Pakistani artist. He teaches at the National College of Arts in Lahore, where he was trained as a traditional Mughal miniature painter, which is a style of manuscript illumination from like the 17th and 18th centuries. He's taken those very careful patterns and pushed them into large-scale architectural kinds of installations. He really broke through with an installation in Sharjah in the UAE at the Sharjah Biennial, where he won the prize, for an installation that covered an entire plaza with red paint that looked from a distance like bloodshed, like a massacre had occurred there. But as you walk over it and atop it, these beautiful traditional foliate patterns that are part of a miniature painting tradition start to emerge. So it becomes this amazing experience of seeing something that feels traumatic and then turns itself into beauty. When he came to the Broad Art Museum to begin conversations about doing a major exhibition inside the museum, we hadn't really considered the idea of him doing that kind of project outside. It was really a collaboration with the city, and particularly Mayor Nathan Triplett, who saw me give a presentation on Imran's work and said, would he ever consider something like that in East Lansing? And I thought, you know, I have no idea. He's going to be here for 2 weeks. Maybe he will. He came and he looked, and I think it's extraordinary what he's done. It has pushed his practice to a whole new place. After he did Sharjah, he did an installation like that on the rooftop of the Metropolitan Museum in New York, but here in downtown East Lansing, it is the first time he's ever done it in a purely public urban setting. So what he's done is a piece called Fragmented, where he's responded to the infrastructure of the city. He's responded to benches and gutters and alleyways and done these pieces that really do from a distance look like a terrible fight occurred or something bloody happened, and then they're really startling in a public context. But as you walk over them, they are stunning and beautiful, and these details of beautiful patterning emerge. So it creates this balance point between kind of a mark of the possibilities of violence that exists certainly for Imran in Pakistan, for us as well in the United States, but then this mark of hope and possibility and tradition and beauty that I think come about. So I think for me it's really important for people to see that the piece is not about bloodshed. The piece is about the possibility of peace.
I hope that when people stumble upon this on the streets and sidewalks of East Lansing, that they take a moment and pause and observe it. Don't just walk over it. because what you say strikes me as quite true, that what appears at first, and it was my first reaction when I walked up to the Ann Street Plaza, oh my gosh, what happened here? It looks like there was a mass shooting or something.
Yeah, absolutely.
And when you look down, it's turned into these beautiful patterns. He's used natural elements, unexpected elements, like a truck driving through the paint at one point, and incorporated these floral designs in what has happened in the course of constructing this project.
Yes, that was a really happy accident, actually, and I didn't know how he would respond. There are a couple of footprints. The truck driving through the big splash of blood at first was a shock. He loves it. It's actually his favorite part of the piece because he's turned the real reality of being in a city and doing a public project where a truck drives through, and all of a sudden these tire treads are filled with these foliate patterns, these little pieces of delicate brushes that feel like leaves almost are falling along the street. I think that's his most exciting thing because he's never had to respond to a pattern that he didn't control before, and it's really wonderful. I hope people will stop and take the time because the work is kind of about a slow process of understanding and slowly moving over it and not just being in the course of our normal lives and running, but really looking.
You know, when people think of outdoor public art, they naturally think of sculpture. This is something you'll have to observe with some care. You may not actually notice it in some places that something has been painted here. It's a new approach, new to me anyway, a new approach to public outdoor art.
I totally agree with that. I think we think of outdoor art as a large-scale metal sculpture that can withstand the elements during the winter and things like that, usually figurative, sometimes abstract. But the idea of a painted installation is, I think, something quite different. Obviously, people do murals and there's graffiti art and things like that. But I think this is really a composition made in two-dimensional form on the streets and sometimes the walls and sometimes the benches of a city. And it's a totally new definition of what public art can be.
It'll be interesting a year from now to see how it's withstood the elements and foot traffic and tire traffic and so on.
Yeah, I agree. I think we have no idea. We're talking with the city about places where we might want to try to put a cover coating on it to let it live a little bit longer. Certainly at the Met, for example, it held up over the course of a very, very long run with rain and even a little snow and probably a million visitors. And it really did held up. It really did hold up in the end. But we have kind of no idea what will happen here.
Well, Allison Gass, thank you so much for bringing Fragmented by Imran Qureshi to the streets of East Lansing. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to have a chance to talk about it. Thanks, Scott.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
WKAR's Current State, live from downtown East Lansing at the East Lansing Art Festival for year number two. We'll be broadcasting live from in front of East Lansing City Hall until 1 o'clock this afternoon. It's been real pleasant to hear from Current State listeners and all kinds of folks who are bundled up a little bit more than they would probably prefer for an East Lansing Art Festival, since it's kind of the unofficial beginning of the summer season. But nonetheless, we got a healthy crowd down here. We hope you can join us. The art festival has more than just visual art, of course. There's lots of live music too, and we're going to hear the music of one of this year's acts, Wissal, in the second hour of our live broadcast, so stick around for that. But we're also delighted to welcome Buzz and Buster to perform for us live today. They'll be playing on the busking stage at 3 o'clock this afternoon. Buzz and Buster, welcome to Current State.
Hey, thanks.
We're going to hear a tune from Buzz and Buster right now called Buster by the Sea. Here they are.
1, 2, 3, 4. Thank you.
Buzz and Buster here live on Current State.
Surprised you, didn't we?
90.5 WKAR. That was called Buster by the Sea?
Yep.
Is that right?
Yep. Okay. Kiss the Instrumental.
Well, we welcome you both to our live broadcast here. You're playing at 3 o'clock this afternoon. Again, you two have been acquainted for about the last 7 years. How did you meet?
That's right. I met you in 2007.
Right. Yeah, I was playing. I was playing the blues festival. I go by Harmonica Buzz. I just fired myself as harmonica player, and he's the new harmonica player. So I play guitar.
Okay, so Harmonica Buzz plays the guitar.
Correct.
And the other guy, Buster,
well,
plays.
Well, you're understanding this really good.
Okay. Well, it's my job.
Right.
So.
We have really different sets. I'll be playing with Jump Up Devil on Sunday, so I'll be playing harmonica with them at 2:30 on the main stage.
I imagine you play harmonica well at all. There's just all kinds of gigging opportunities out there. Is that the case?
Well, you got to no,
but it's not.
You
got to
make your
okay.
own way there. We no, but it's kind of unique. We have different styles. Do you want to see how I play, and I'll show you what the difference between we play?
Well, lay it on us.
Okay, so my style is, well, Buster is like. He's kind of a Chicago blues guy. He's the masters there. So why don't you give him a little stuff there?
Buster. So you describe that as Chicago blues style.
Yeah, he's really good with Little Walter. He loves... who are the people you like there, Buster? Who are the people you like a lot? Sonny Boy Williamson, Little Walter, Snooky Pryor.
Yeah,
who else?
That's right. I love all the progressions of the Chicago blues. It gives you slow blues, shuffle blues, boogie blues, and I love that rolling note style to it, note bending.
Yeah. Okay,
progressions
he
like
does,
that.
He does. Yeah, the way his brain works, he can pretty much imitate the masters pretty much exactly.
And how does that differ from the way you play?
Well, I play more percussively. I play from a guy, Phil Wiggins, who's entire harmonica duo Cephas and Wiggins was known for. He plays on his own now after John passed, but John was out here in 1999. John and Phil were here in 1999. That's where I met them, and so that's where my kind of musical journey started with the Great Lakes Folk Festival, meeting Phil right over here, so down the street over at Albert and Abbott.
Okay.
But my style is more percussive, and I call myself kind of a tongue picker, so this is kind of some stuff.
Harmonica Buzz there on Current State here in downtown East Lansing from the East Lansing Art Festival. You've both played with Root Doctor, pretty well-known band around town.
Well, we played with...
Me and with Open Jam. The town gives you a chance to get with local electric bands,
with electric,
Open Jams.
Bradley's learned a lot from like Andy Wilson, who's a great harmonica player. I consider him one of the best players in the world. And he's learned a lot from Freddie Cunningham, the singer with Root Doctor. About blues, so.
And Buzz, you've made two CDs, correct?
Two harmonica Buzz CDs, one called Long Way to Memphis, and the other called Peace for My Baby. And we're looking to get a Buzz and Buster CD together called Don't Let the Future Get in the Way. We're trying to combine Buster's aviation artwork. So we have this piece of artwork here.
There's my other
print.
Hobby right there, visual
really
artwork.
Buzz, yeah, this is just a unique, this is an extraordinary thing.
I do artwork from actual aerial photos I take. I get aerial tour plane rides from Grand Air Aviation at Abrams Airport in Grand Ledge. And once every few months, I take aerial photo and put the airplane in there. Very detailed with colored pencils.
Right.
So it's more detailed than paintings. Right?
We actually started working on last spring, April Fool's Day, actually, video in my house to see if we got a CD recorded. And it turned out we didn't get that, but we ended up getting that. We flew over East Lansing and video documented that. And we have this piece of artwork over these very grounds right here.
There's a slogan, Buster. You have a slogan on your YouTube video called Guitar, Harmonica, and Aviation Artwork.
That's right, yeah.
So that's a kind of a unique crossroads that you occupy. It sounds kind of lonely, to tell you the truth. I'm not
well,
sure
actually, it's the other way around. We're looking, and right now it's lonely, but what we're looking to do is work with communities to fly over the community, go make a music and art presentation. So if we start working with charities and that, we can fly over anywhere. You know, we float over Grand Ledge. He's completing Charlotte right now. The next one we want to fly over is Detroit, get out of Lansing a little bit. We as Lansing done. So we'd like to end up working with charities and making a music presentation.
So,
and
so do you present, you obviously perform at the East Lansing Art Festival. Do you also present the art at the art festival? Do you have a place for that or
what?
We'll
do it. We'll be at our gigs. We'll have it available.
Okay.
So,
is either one of you, are you a pilot? Buster?
No, well, maybe sometime.
right now, just
yeah,
a passenger.
I'm very interested in aviation and navigation quite a bit. Maybe someday. I go on the plane ride. I'm just really excited, taking a lot of aerial photos. And
he's been really, you know, it's.
I think I can get better photos.
He's made friends with some of the best musicians in town, learned a lot from them. He's made friends with pilots to make this all possible in that.
Buzz, you're going to play with Jump Up the Devil.
Jump Up Devil.
Jump Up Devil, yep. I beg your pardon, on the main stage tomorrow afternoon at 2:30 p.m. Tell us about Jump
Real
Up Devil.
Real interesting act. Country Blues, Bruce Comfort is actually the first curator of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Museum and a Robert Johnson historian. So for me to play a harmonica with him is great because I kind of specialize in finger pickers. And he's just a fantastic finger picker. But we've also expanded it to where we have Annie Crawford on piano. So she plays boogie piano, sings, and plays fiddle. So it's incredibly interesting for me to play with a great finger picker, a boogie piano player, and then to play off the fiddle with harmonica. And then the other bonus is that Bradley's on two of the songs on the CD, too.
Oh, excellent.
So we have probably he's going to sit on the last song, and we're going to do a two harmonica piece on the last song.
Do you think appearances at the East Lansing Art Festival help expand your fan base? Do you know does that make much of a difference?
Well, to me it's about the experience. Music has changed and it's so different. I mean, everybody's got so many things to do with television and all that, but this is where we meet new people. And my own personal experience in East Lansing meeting Phil Wiggins, I wouldn't be a musician if it wasn't for the festivals like this.
Okay.
And the open jams for me.
Right. So we wouldn't be doing, if it wasn't for the Great Lakes Folk Festival coming in, me and Phil Wiggins, I wouldn't be doing this. I wouldn't have him as a friend. We wouldn't be doing this. So.
We're talking with Buzz and Buster here on Current State on WKAR, live from the East Lansing Art Festival. How much have you guys played outside of the greater Lansing area?
Not too much. We play in Saginaw at the White Crow Museum. Ultimately, if we go over Detroit, we should be able to play in Detroit,
But it's pretty much limited to Michigan.
Well, it's that's where we play now. That's our home. You got to play in your home, man, once the musician goes somewhere, then they're kind of known for something else. So.
You guys have day jobs, or is music a full-time thing? Music and aviation, sorry.
I live at an adult foster care home right now, and I work at Peckham Bundling Fabric. They make military uniforms at Peckham. So I work 2 days a week, short shifts, bundling fabric. And
are you both native Michiganders?
No, I was born in New York and lived in Connecticut, Iowa, Illinois, and Michigan, went to school in D.C., but I've been here for a long time, so I'm from Lansing.
I'm right here in Lansing.
Okay, very good. Well, I tell you what, we got one more song that we want to hear from you. What are you going to take us out
with? This one's called Don't Let the Future Get in the Way, and it has Buster, we're calling this Buster's Glimpse. We're going to put his video or his prints on eBay as Buster's Glimpse of East Lansing and that. So anyway, he wanted me, what did you tell me?
Oh, I remember when we first met each other, I knew you were writing quite a bit of songs, and I just was joking around asking you, can you put my name or mention me in one of your lyrics? So in this one right here, my name.
So I got Buster gets a glimpse through his airplane rides, and he brings it back to Earth, lets his harmonicas fly.
Well, live from the crossroads where aviation and harmonica meet, it's Buzz and Buster. Don't let the future get in the way.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Mark.
She said the future never comes to date. And she said, don't let the future get in your way. Might as well gaze into an okay ball. Or put it on the winter, or maybe next fall.
silver's worth nothing if a gold is your dream. I climb the mountain, but I miss my stream. I was into something that just slips away. You see a rabbit on a log between a couple paydays. So you want a rabbit pull, you want to pin him down. Well, Johnny be good, the silver's round and round. So said the future never comes, never comes today. It's just that don't let the future get ahead in your way. Nothing's quite as simple, this what something's for. Lost in a dream or that old blue car. Buzzer gets a glance through as they're playing rats. But then it brings it back to earth, which is a Monica's fly. Better to simplify your day. Back to the root of what you want to play. The gaze at the mountain is the bend of the stream. Silver's worth nothing if a gold is your dream. If you want to find an angel, gotta find out where she fell. And she tell ya, don't let the future get in your way. Sister, don't let the future get in your way. Sister, don't let the future get in your way. Sister, don't let the future get in your way. Simplify. And simplify. And simplify. Don't let the future get in your way. She says, don't let the future get in your way. She says, don't let the future get in your way. She says, don't let the future get in your way. She says, don't let the future get in your way. She says, don't let the future get in your way. She says, don't let the future get in your way. Says, don't let the future get ahead of you. Says, don't let the future get ahead of you. Says, don't let the future get ahead of you. Says, don't let the future get ahead of you. And simplify.
Buzz and Buster live on WKAR's Current State. We want to thank both of those guys for their two performances here today. They'll be performing later on this afternoon at the East Lansing Art Festival. You are tuned to 90.5 WKAR East Lansing, NPR, and classical music and Current State from right in front of East Lansing City Hall here. Today's programming is made possible in part by a contribution from Ruth Lewis in honor of her deceased husband Glenn's 100th birthday. We'll be here until 1 o'clock this afternoon. We encourage you to stop on by. It's been great to chew the fat with a number of Current State listeners here during our visit to downtown East Lansing. We've actually got a little sunshine going down here right now. So I think that the temperature has climbed to maybe 45 or so. Something like that. There are a few Canadian artists who are probably weathering the weather really easily here at the East Lansing Art Festival, and we're going to talk to one here right now. among the hundreds exhibiting the work, several Canadians are here, and it turns out that with all of our customs and immigration regulations, it's actually quite complicated for them to be able to sell their art here. To help give us a sense of what that process is like, we're joined now by David Solomon. David's a fine woodworker who drove down here yesterday from Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario. David, welcome to East Lansing.
Thanks very much.
What made you decide to attend the and to exhibit your stuff at the East Lansing Art Festival?
Well, I'd heard a lot of good things about Michigan shows, in particular the East Lansing Art Festival, and so I decided to apply, and luckily I was successful this year. I've heard a lot of good things about Michigan shows in general.
And you've brought what appears to be a really beautiful piece of your own work here. It looks very ornate and beautiful. Tell us what you've brought.
It's a box that, generally I make one new box a year, and this is the one I made for 2014. It's a box called Norma Box. It's mainly made of ebony with some pink ivory and some accent wood called spalted maple, which actually I get locally from our cottage property.
And we described you as a fine woodworker, and I'm sure you are a fine woodworker, but fine also refers to the woods that you work with. Am I right about that? I mean...
Most of my boxes are made from exotic woods, either from South America, from Africa, from Asia. And I tend to focus on precision work, and I hope that's reflected in the pieces that I make.
Did you have a mentor who taught you woodworking, or how did you learn to do this?
Strictly self-taught. I've been passionate about wood for all my life. And I think after you make enough mistakes, you actually get to be fairly good at it. So, no, I've never taken a course. Like I say, I've learned through the School of Hard Knots, if you want to say.
Very interesting. This is the second year that you've been to an art festival in Michigan. This is your first time to East Lansing,
first time correct? East Lansing. Last year I was in a show in St. Joseph, Michigan, over right on Lake Michigan, Point. South of Holland, Krasel Art Fair on the Bluff. Another great show. They tend to get 60,000 to 70,000 people through in 2 days.
As a Canadian citizen, what did you have to do to get here?
There's three things you really have to do. When you're bringing goods across the border for sale in the States, you're considered as a commercial carrier. The first thing you have to do is actually register your vehicle as a commercial vehicle. You have to get a number, which you do off the Internet. It costs you about $80 a year to do that. The second and most important thing is, if you're bringing over $2,000 worth of goods, you have to arrange for a customs broker to prepare the documentation to submit to the customs officers at the point you're going to be crossing into the States.
How do you find a customs broker?
You can go on the Internet and look up the names of various U.S. brokers.
Okay.
I had one who was recommended to me, and I followed through with that. That process is probably the most complicated of the things you have to do. You have to provide them with a description of the pieces, the material, the value, and then they prepare the proper documentation and will highlight any particular issues with the things that you're planning on bringing across.
And you're bringing in wood. I mean, does that complicate the process?
Well, it does, because wood comes under what they call the Lacey Act, which controls export and import of endangered species. So, again, it's up to the customs broker to highlight to you whether you are going to run into any potential issues, with the woods that you're going to bring across.
Well, everybody in Michigan who's here, lives here, and visits on a regular basis has seen the billboards and the bumper stickers, "Don't haul your wood from one end of the state to the other," because sometimes all kinds of insects that get into that wood end up being transferred to other places that are not terribly desirable.
No, and the same thing in Canada. Now, the one thing at the border that they ask you is whether you're bringing any wood across that has bark on it, and it's for that particular reason, is that it could actually be hiding some insects that they don't necessarily want to bring into the country. So you're restricted. You can't bring any wood across that actually has bark on it. My pieces don't, so I'm fine that way.
We're talking with Canadian fine woodworker David Solomon, who's giving us a perspective of a Canadian artist who is exhibiting his work here in East Lansing and in Michigan. Are there some pieces you can't bring with you?
There are certain woods that you can't bring across the border. So you have to be very careful. Like I say, it'll be up to the customs broker to highlight those particular woods and, you know, make sure that you're not bringing any of those woods across with you.
And there's a third step involved here, David. You have to find an American citizen to actually sell your wares, I understand.
Yes, because I'm not a U.S. citizen, I can't be the person actually taking care of the sales transaction in my booth. So I have to hire someone locally to take care of that for me.
We've got quite a ways to go before we become like the European Union. You know, you just drive across the border from France to Germany and back and forth, and there's nothing. You have to go through a fair amount of red tape, is what it
boils down
to.
Well, we do, you know, but I suspect that coming into Canada, you'd face some of the same issues. So you just have to be aware of them and, you know, make sure that you make the proper arrangements. And, I mean, I have no problem crossing now that I know all of those particular issues that I'm going
to
face.
And to clarify here, you can't ring up the customer and accept payment?
No, I can't be the person handling the sales transactions. Mm. The way that it's looked at is that's a job, and it needs to be handled by a U.S. citizen.
Interesting. And how do you find somebody to do that for you?
Well, the festival was kind enough to put forward the names of a couple of people. Now, I contacted them directly and arranged with them to take care of the sales in my booth.
Would you be more inclined to show your stuff in Michigan if there were less red tape? It sounds like it. I mean,
Well, there certainly would be less cost involved. But I enjoy the Michigan shows. I think you get treated very well at the shows that I've been at. They're well organized. They have large crowds and, I think, very knowledgeable crowds. So I enjoy the shows, and I think I'd still come even though I face those same hurdles.
How many separate pieces did you bring with you today?
I think I have about 30-some pieces with me between boxes, and I also make what are called serving boards, which are very decorative and what some people think are quite beautiful.
Serving boards? What are those?
They're boards that you would use, let's say, if you had prepared some appetizers or something. You would put the plates on these boards. They're more of an art piece, but they are functional as well.
Are you a full-time artist, David?
No, I'm retired from my real job, and I'm able now to spend a lot of time at my passion, which is woodworking. So I do this mainly as a hobby.
David Solomon is a fine woodworker from Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario, who's talking about the Canadian artist experience here in Michigan, and specifically at the East Lansing Art Festival. It's David's first visit to the East Lansing Art Festival. Do you attend a lot of festivals like these, or do you exhibit at a lot of festivals like these?
This year I'm only going to be doing two shows out of the city of Sault Ste. Marie. I'll be doing the East Lansing Art Festival and the Krazzle Art Fair on the Bluff in St. Joseph, Michigan. Last year I was lucky enough. That was my first year in the Krazzle Show, and I was awarded Best in Show in the wood category, so I'm exempt from the jurying process there this year. So,
Where's your booth?
Number 47 down on Mac. Is it Mac Avenue?
MAC.
MAC.
If you're
Avenue.
An insider, it's MAC.
MAC.
Michigan Avenue. Agricultural College,
that
which
was explained
is
to
which
me.
Is what this enormous university across the street used to be called.
Right.
Have you been to East Lansing at all in your life before?
Not prior
this
to
this is your
attending.
Very first visit to
this
East
is it,
Lansing.
And I'm quite impressed.
Okay. Well, we hope to have you back. And I don't know. I'm inclined to say we hope we can eliminate a little bit of red tape there for you. It was interesting to hear about all the hoops you have to
well,
jump
Well, thanks
through.
Very much.
David Solomon, a fine woodworker from Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario, here on WKAR's Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. We're here live until 1 o'clock this afternoon in front of the East Lansing City Hall. More live music coming our way right now from the nearby soundstage here in the city parking lot just north of City Hall. And you'll be hearing music all weekend coming from that and other venues here in East Lansing. Traditionally, the East Lansing Art Festival has been one of the first big dog days in the city. But is bringing your pet to an event like this a good idea? Well, to talk about that and other warm weather dog health issues, we turn to Dr. Gail Wolf of Bennett Road Animal Clinic in Okemos. Dr. Wolf received her DVM from Michigan State University's Vet School in 1970. She spoke with Current State's Melissa Benmark.
As we enter the summer season with people taking their dogs out in particular to public events like the East Lansing Art Festival, ball games, you know, whatever, what are things that people need to watch? Because I find myself wondering about things like pavement temperature and concrete exposure to their joints and that kind of thing. What do you find that people need to watch taking their dogs out this time of year?
Well, the main problem is heat exhaustion. If it's very hot, they, from walking along in the heat, will get very hot and it could be dangerous to their life. And they also could get dehydrated even before the point of heat stroke.
What are the signs that, the dog is not doing well with the heat?
Excessive panting, for one thing. That's how they perspire. And if they are slowing down, not jauntily walking along, that's a sign of danger as well.
Do they have trouble with the pavement at all?
Yes, their pads could burn if the pavement is very hot. If it's hot enough to burn your feet, if you were barefoot, it's hot enough to burn theirs.
So is there a way to sort of figure out in advance, like a certain temperature, for instance, that you wouldn't want to take them out past or that kind of thing?
If it's a sunny day in the anything above 75, I'd have some concerns. Like I say, you can test it by walking yourself on the bare ground. If it's hot for you, it will be hot for them.
One of the things that always makes me crazy this time of year is people leaving dogs in their car over the summer. And I always wonder, I mean, what can somebody do who sees that?
You can call animal control or the police, because that should they should come very quickly, because within 15 minutes it could be life-threatening from the time the door is closed.
Why do you think people persist in doing that? Because you'd think they'd be well publicized enough anymore that people wouldn't still leave their dogs in the car like that.
It must be that mentality, it won't happen to me. But it could.
When you get dogs together in a situation, obviously they're unleashed, but in a situation like the art festival where there are a bunch of them together at an event, what kinds of things do people need to be aware of that they might not be otherwise aware of in terms of keeping their dog and other people's dogs safe?
Well, I don't think it's a good idea to bring dogs to a public place like the East Lansing Art Fair. First of all, there can be aggression between dogs as they pass each other on the sidewalk. They also could get quite nervous and anxious around crowds, so many people, that it's not a good idea. It could lead to a bite from fear or just aggression from dog to dog, too.
A couple of other things we've seen in the last couple of years. Last year, I believe the tick season was supposed to be particularly bad. Do you have a sense of how that's going to be this year, or have you heard early reports?
The ticks are supposed to be coming to this area more and more each year. I haven't seen very many, though. The Okemos area is not too bad yet, but it could get that way.
Where are they coming from?
Oh, there's a lot of ticks in Maryland, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. So it'll be here soon.
Any parting advice to people who are maybe road tripping with their dogs this summer?
Well, if they're going to a tick-infested area, they should vaccinate their dogs for Lyme disease. And they could also use flea and tick prevention, the once-a-month products now. They're very good topical products, and there's a preventive collar that can be used. So they need to be prepared before they leave in those affected areas.
I'm Mark Bayshore. We are live from the downtown East Lansing here for the East Lansing Art Festival. In addition to the art, people love attending outdoor festivals like the East Lansing Art Festival for the food. More than two dozen different food vendors will set up today and tomorrow here in downtown East Lansing, serving everything from wood-fired brick oven pizza to multi-flavored gourmet granola, to slow, fast food. Slow, fast food. In fact, that's the specialty of our next guest. Jesse Hahn is chef and co-owner of the Trailer Parked Slow Fast Food Trailer. Trailer Parked is a fixture at the East Lansing Farmers Market and elsewhere around town. It's one of three food businesses Jesse Hahn and his partners operate. Jesse, welcome to Current State.
Oh, thank you for having me.
First things first, you just marked your third anniversary of Trailer Parked, and you're set up this weekend here at the Art Festival. Trailer Parked would seem to be a natural for an event like this.
Exactly, yeah. You know, we take a lot of pride and a lot of craft into what we do, so we feel like, you know, this is a good venue, and there's a lot of clientele that are interested in what we're doing here. So,
what other festivals do you plan to hit here during the warm weather months?
We'll be doing the Jazz Festival here in a couple weekends, right here in East
Summer
Lansing.
Solstice.
Yep,
jazz.
Summer
okay.
Solstice. Yeah. We'll be doing the Festival of the Sun. We're doing the you know, the farmers markets at the Capitol this year. There's three of them this summer. We'll be doing Harvest Gathering at the end of the summer. A bunch of other festivals.
What's the response you get from Trailer Parked? How's it going?
You know, with a name like Trailer Parked, it's very unassuming. You think, you know, it's kind of deminimizes what the craft and the focus behind it. So it kind of a surprise. You know, it's like people aren't, you know, they see tacos and they're just not expecting the flavor and the pop and the amount of work that we put into every single thing we make. You know.
How many satisfied Trailer Parked customers end up visiting your bricks and mortar restaurant in Lansing? Do you convert as many of your Trailer Parked visitors into restaurant customers as you'd like?
Yeah, I'd like to hope so. We you know, it's our calling card to get out into the community and see the people and be seen and really show them what we perceive as food and you know, it's all coming from this great local community. So just.
Earlier this week, we reported on a spot in downtown Lansing that is being taken over by food trailers. Are you a participant in that?
No, we're not a participant currently. Okay. Well, we have a lot on our plate this summer with what we've already we've already decided to take on. It's not something that we'd be opposed to doing, but just not anything in the works as of yet.
There's actually three parts to your business all together, and there's just a few of you who do it all. So you've already got lots going on. Mm-hmm. How big a menu do you typically offer when you take Trailer Parked out on the road?
You know, 4 to 5 items, really limited, that we can dial in and really execute at a high volume and, you know, turn over quickly and still, you know, achieve all the things that we're trying to achieve. You know, the slow fast food, it goes into, you know, the slow part is how the food is produced. The fast is how we produce it during the you know, the event or whatever we might be vending at.
Okay. And now, do you change your menu much from event to event?
We usually always stay with a taco theme. We have our bolognese tacos and veggie tacos. Today we're doing some smoked pork shoulder arepas. We're also doing some really delicious nachos. We have our house-made sage lemonade and a little bit of lighted organic iced tea and then bottled water. Pretty simple, but
sounds fantastic. Before we get in more into the second business that you launched, Fork in the Road, explain how you got in the restaurant or the food business in the first place.
Well, I mean, I've really done it my whole life. My mom helped run a catering company when I was a kid, so I've been, you know, skirting tables and bussing suds since I was about 6. You know, got my first dishwashing job when I was 12, but you know, and just kind of always done this, and always all I've ever really wanted to do was own a restaurant, you know.
You've got some big city experience, too, though, Jesse. Opus One in Detroit, for one. What did you take from the Opus One experience and your other big city, big restaurant experience?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Opus One was great. It was a great vessel. I was the executive sous there, so I really got to, you know, focus on, you know, what people wanted and what, you know, where I was taking my cuisine at the time. I think the best thing that I took out of it is that I want to cook for people like, you know, myself and people in this Lansing community, and fine dining is really kind of a dying breed as far as you know, what our economy and what we can support. So it's really just, you know, that whole circling the wagon mentality and finding what we have locally and not trying to bring in truffles from France and wherever else, and trying to cook with that same focus and that same passion that you see in fine dining restaurants, and doing it on a different scale.
Did your stop at Opus One, and I know you were in Chicago for a while as well, do you feel Fork in the Road is better because of those stops
you
made?
Yeah. Absolutely.
I know sustainability is something that you care an awful lot about. How does concern for sustainability play out in your food businesses?
You know, we're just trying to limit the amount of our footprint, you know, restaurants and small businesses alike. You know, we consume so much, and we're bringing so much through our doors, and we're trying to turn a lot of that stuff around as far as, you know, from the dish chemicals we use to the to-go items that we use. But we're really looking at it from the front right now, because we've focused on that the back end for the last couple of years, and really trying to start producing some stuff for ourselves, as far as like tomatoes for ourselves, so we can can them and produce our own ketchup year round, and using our own tomatoes out of season and what's available in season.
You've just bought some farmland here, which we'll talk about here in a little bit, which is really the third leg on the stool. Mm-hmm. That is all of your businesses, the trailer park, fork on the road, and now the farmland. Where does this sustainability ethos, where did that come from? When did that start to register with you?
I guess I was doing a cook-off at Cargill for a pork competition about 5 years ago, and then realized that, you know, a lot about where that meat came from and what I was participating in, and I was really just kind of, you know, Not ashamed, I guess. Yeah, ashamed that, you know, I was participating in something that was part of the machine, for lack of a better term. So we're just really trying to be ourselves inside of the ramifications of what we're allowed to be, you know, and really trying to change, you know, the structure of our food system.
I've heard it many times said, you know, pointed out to me by some friends who are vegetarians, mm-hmm. how much energy gets spent in order to create meat. You grow grain in order to feed the animals. You there's all the transportation and everything involved.
Mm-hmm. That's why we try to, you know, get happy animals locally, and you know, not, we do a ton of meat, you know, and we're really meat focused, but really vegetable focused as too, and just understanding that, you know, everything is good in moderation. You know, I'm not a vegetarian. I eat a lot of meat, you know, I'm not trying to eat a piece of meat that had a plane ticket to get here and needed 300 gallons of water to produce 1 pound of, or whatever the ratio is. You know, it just seems kind of crazy, especially with where we are at, and with, you know, even the weather that we have today. And, you know, what is it, May 17th and 18th?
You'd
and
it's, never it's, know it,
yeah.
but
it feels like fall.
The,
you know,
polar, like, vortex is sticking around.
Did
here.
Did we do something to make this angry mad? I think we need to start righting the ship. You know.
Well, as if running a good restaurant isn't a ton of work already, you are really selective about your ingredients. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit more about that. I mean, you mentioned working with local producers and distributors.
Well, you know, we have there's a ton of, you know, great farmers and producers in this area. Like, one would be Owasso Organics, who I've known Richard and Pooh, the proprietors there, my whole life. Actually, we shot our Kickstarter video for the trailer when we were doing some crowdfunding for that in one of their hoop houses. And they've just been so instrumental along the way of, you know, just trying to, you know, even when I was a kid, trying to teach me about real food, you know, and my family and my grandparents as well. But, you know, just trying to instill a value associated with food.
And you, as I mentioned a minute ago, you have purchased a couple plots of land here now where you're actually growing crops. Where are those? How much land are we talking about?
it's about 200.
One's right at the fork in the road, correct?
Yeah. We have a little garden at the fork in the road. We have, you know, 8 small raised beds there and some stuff that we grow around. We do a lot of vertical stuff there to visually appeal and bring people in from the road, you know, okras and sunflowers, and a lot of practical stuff too. We grow a ton of herbs there. And out in Shaftsburg at my family's land that they're letting me farm this year, we're growing a ton of peppers, tomatoes, cucumbers, you know, a lot of cold store crops, and a lot of stuff we can put up for the fall and winter and early spring.
I feel like I'm talking to the busiest guy in Ingham County. I know how much work the restaurant business is alone here, and you've really got 3 parts to your business. Do you feel like you've developed a loyal clientele?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And we couldn't do it without the great staff that we have at Fork in the Road and Trailer Parked.
How many people do you employ?
I think we just reached 19 this week. So, and that fluctuates a little during the summer. It'll go up and go down, and we usually operate around 15 to 16 people.
We should remind, I think, the people who haven't heard about Fork in the Road, where you are exactly. You are in a fork in the road.
Exactly. We're right where Saginaw and Oakland meet on Lansing's west side.
And you're apt to see trailer parked all over the place, including here at the East Lansing Art Festival here for this weekend. for our listeners who haven't been to Fork in the Road yet, how big? Tell us how big a place it is. How many square feet?
Yeah, it's about 2,700 square feet. We have 44 seats, so it's a small little diner, but it's nice and cozy and a lot of fun going on and excitement and nice folks. So,
and again, the emphasis really all across your businesses is the farm to table approach. Mm-hmm. You pretty much eliminate the middleman,
exactly.
So to speak. You are the farmer, yeah. You are the producer. What's it like being in charge of all of these operations? How is being in charge of all of these different operations different from what you might have expected 5 years ago in your career? Has this just unfolded, or was this part of a plan you had a long time ago?
Yeah, it's been part of the plan. It's a lot of work, but, you know, you see the reward in it. You know, we spent, I don't even know how many hours just, you know, cutting sod and rolling sod and tilling and laying compost and laying finishing soil. And it's been a month and a half long process trying to get this field ready to actually grow in. And we put in seed last week, and we got some asparagus crowns in the ground, and just actually seeing stuff sprout and come to fruition, it makes it definitely all worth it. So,
how many hours a week do you work?
It depends. At least 70.
I was going to say, I asked you the question, and I thought, if this guy doesn't work 80 hours a week, I'll be absolutely amazed. Well, it's been great to learn more about Trailer Park and Fork in the Road and your farming venture. Mm-hmm. Jesse Hahn is the guy behind Trailer Park and Fork in the Road, and you can see Trailer Park and their cuisine here, offering up various cuisine. Specialty is the tacos, from what I understand, here at the East Lansing Art Festival. Jesse, continued success.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you having us.
It's Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. We've got an eclectic blend of art genres here in East Lansing, and one of the newest and most exciting frontiers is digital art, compositions made completely on a computer. Digital artist John Lieben from Saugatuck has been experimenting with this mode for several years. He spoke with Current State's Kevin Lavery about how he got started as an artist and how he turned in his paintbrush for pixels.
I've always been into fine art. During my career, I was also a documentary filmmaker. In fact, I've had some programs on public television as well, so I'm kind of like going back to my roots. In the last 10 years or so, I've been concentrating on my fine art and kind of gave up on the filmmaking career.
Well, that sort of segues a little bit into digital art, and maybe it doesn't. What is digital art to you? How would you describe what you do?
Well, you know, it probably is a good segue because, as you know, there's a lot of digital media in television and video. So I kind of learned the Macintosh computer pretty intimately, working in video and television. And a lot of those skills I've taken to creating my work now. So right now I'm focusing on working on the computer. Probably the last 10 years I've been working almost strictly on the computer as my fine art medium. And I use a couple of different programs. I have a pretty good knowledge of Photoshop, but I also use a painting program called ArtRage, which is really a program I use for rendering my pictures.
How do you actually take something from a photograph that might be your inspiration for the art to your own creation, realizing that you're not copying the photograph?
The actual process, I do use a lot of photographs. I use photographs that I take myself. I use photographs that I find. And the picture I'm featuring at the East Lansing Art Festival, it's called Outhouse Island. For instance, this picture is made up of probably 100 photographs that I've either found or took, and I cut out these photographs, put them together into a montage, and typically I use Photoshop to do that. I work in layers. People who are familiar with Photoshop know what that means, I guess. You know, it's like you could stack up layers on top of each other and manipulate them independently of each other. So it's kind of a fun way to create a composition. I use Photoshop to create an initial composition using photographs. So once I get a composition I like, which could take weeks, and it could take like up to 100 or more layers of imagery, then I use that as a reference for rendering a painting using my painting program. I use palette knives, paint brushes, chalk, crayons, pencils, any number of media to create my images. Once I create that finished painting, then I'll bring it back into Photoshop and manipulate it even further using digital tools, which is why the medium is so exciting, because there's so much stuff you could do with it. And the other great thing about digital media is that you're able to erase very easily. If you make a mistake, you just kind of back up. And there's a lot of mistakes made during the creation of a typical digital painting.
I can imagine. I think the eraser is probably the most powerful tool for any artist. That includes people who are in the publication industry as well, too.
That's true.
You talk about colorization of your paintings. Again, you don't have a physical paintbrush in your hand. So I'm curious as to how you convey force. Solid objects are solid. More delicate objects are delicate. A traditional artist who has a color wheel, a palette in his hand, can mix four or five different colors and create something that maybe they think is even their own shade. And they can physically do that and not rely upon a computer program. How does that translate?
You know, it's not all that different from working directly on a canvas with wet paint, because I could lay down a blue and I could lay down a red color, and then I could take a palette knife and I could smear those together, mix them together, and come up with a violet. So it's very similar to that. It's a matter of smearing stuff together, just like you smear stuff on a canvas with a paintbrush or a palette knife. But you're working obviously on a computer screen, so another advantage is that I have the ability to zoom in on certain areas, just like an artist might walk up to a canvas and work on a small area very close. Then the artist will step back and look at what he's done, how it relates to the entire composition. Then he'll go back and work on another small area. I mean, I do the same thing on my computer screen.
Is digital art really catching on as a genre? And do you yourself have any personal Picassos you look up to in this format?
Well, let me put it this way. 10 years ago, when I would enter an art fair or enter an art competition at a museum, if I mentioned that I was entering a piece of art that I did digitally on my computer, often I would get rejected. And it was not a respected medium. And there's really good reason for that. Digital media has just really come into its own probably in the last 7 or 8 years, because the technology is there to make it possible to create a very permanent, you know, high-quality image on canvas or paper that's going to last as long as the old masters would last. So it's only in the last 7 or 8 years that that's been possible to do. If you go into any art school, I think you'd find that at least 50% of the kids are working digitally now. So it's a pretty exciting medium.
To what extent are you really driven by your own creative vision, your own muse, versus something sort of on demand for a customer who is looking for something different and new and not traditional, and that's maybe where digital art fits the bill for them?
Well, a couple ways to answer that question, I guess. I work in lots of different imagery. I mean, I like to work on landscape. I like to work, you know, I like to paint trees. I like to paint boats. I like to paint, you know, one of the big things I'm famous for around here in Saugatuck is my stairway pictures. I paint stairway, you know, beach stairs. You walk along the beach and there's, you know, every other house has got a stairway, you know, down to the beach. So, I paint conventional landscape type pictures, as well as, you know, the more far out pictures like Outhouse Island. You know, I'm not sure that I have any preference between the two directions that I travel in, but as I exhibit more and more, my far out pictures are being, you know, more readily accepted by the public than my more conventional landscape pictures.
You mentioned your featured work, Outhouse Island. What other things can patrons of the East Lansing Art Festival expect to see at your booth this weekend?
There are several pictures along the lines of Outhouse Island, and I call them my urban renewal series. And that series actually started with a bunch of pictures I used from Detroit, old abandoned buildings, and I started stacking them up on top of each other like I did with the outhouses. And I was kind of thinking, here's what a demented city planner might do with these abandoned buildings in Detroit. You know, it's kind of a tongue-in-cheek approach to urban renewal. I'll be showing some of those. I've been working with balloons, hot air balloons, that are kind of fun. I've got some hot air balloon pictures that are kind of carrying around a stack of buildings. I've got a image of which I call a boat town, which is a stack of houses that are on a boat. One called Tree Town, which is a tree house. You know, it's a tree that's got a village on it. So, you know, pictures like that have been pretty well accepted by the public in the last couple of years.
John Lieben is a digital artist from Saugatuck. His featured work at the East Lansing Art Festival is entitled Outhouse Island. John, we thank you very much for talking with us. Have a great exhibition.
Great. Thank you, Kevin.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And you're tuned to 90.5 WKAR. We are broadcasting Current State live today, the second year in a row from the East Lansing Art Festival in front of East Lansing City Hall. I'm Mark Bayshore. The Arabic word wisal means links, connections, or unities. Wisal is also the name of the Mediterranean fusion group based here in Lansing. Wisal's music fuses elements of the Mediterranean musical heritage with klezmer, Indian, and American influences. Here to perform live on Current State, it's Wisal. This is Hejaz Mendira. Thank you. Jaz Mendira. It's Wissal here on Current State, live in front of East Lansing City Hall here for the East Lansing Art Festival. Jaz Mendira was the name of that track. I'm going to go down the row here and have each one of you identify yourself and then tell me what instrument you play.
Well, I'm Ben Furman, and I'm playing the mandolin.
Ben Furman playing the eight string mandolin.
Yep.
Okay.
My name's Igor Huat, and I play the 11-string oud, the Middle Eastern lute.
The 11-string
yes.
Oud, which is a Middle Eastern lute.
Yes. I think the calculation in the group is that we've got 23 strings, right? When everybody's here.
You add up all the strings, you got 23. It's a great sound.
My name is Will Sikola. I play the zero-stringed clarinet. I've also got the Turkish clarinet here. And sometimes I play the sax in this group, the saxophone, but that hasn't got any strings either.
Okay. Well, we had plenty of strings going already, as it turns out. So.
My name is Ty Forker. I play, this is a dumbek. It's kind of an hourglass-shaped drum that comes from the Middle East.
That is a beautiful instrument, the dumbek. And you?
My name is Mike List. I'm playing a special Middle Eastern tambourine that is called the rick.
The rick. Okay, so we have learned all of the instruments that we heard on that last song. Where is Wissal playing this weekend at the East Lansing Art Festival?
We'll be playing at the main stage tomorrow, so Sunday, May 18, from 11:30 till 12:30.
Are you busier in the summertime? I mean, do the festival circuit? Are you busy on the festival?
This year
circuit?
We're busier, yes. We're going to be playing Spirit of the Woods on June the 22nd up north. We're going to be playing a couple of places in Detroit and Grand Rapids, too. So this summer is pretty busy until June or July, yeah.
And Igor, tell us more about how you guys managed to get together.
All right. So everybody except for Mike here is an MSU grad. And we had a lot of interest in different type of world cultures. And at the music school here at MSU, you either play jazz or you play classical music or you're part of the big bands, you know, the marching band and so on and so forth. So one day I just sent out a Facebook message. It was an Indian friend who used to be part of the group too. We sent out a Facebook message and had everybody come in for a rehearsal. We were maybe like 12 people in our first rehearsal. We just jammed and we pared down to this group we have nowadays. 4 years later.
Well, it's a terrific sound. You've gathered quite an audience here. It's amazing what an audience you gather when you guys all get to rocking. And Will Sikola's got a zero-stringed clarinet all set to go, so I don't want to keep Will waiting a second long. Actually, he's stuck it down his hoodie, so it's hard to keep your fingers warm today, unfortunately. We need more Mediterranean weather here in East Lansing. That's our problem. What are you going to play next?
Breeze from the South. It's this tune,
yes,
by a Lebanese composer, and hopefully it will be an omen of things to come. Yeah, right?
Breeze from the South. Yes. It's Wissal on Current State on WKAR. Whistle here on Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Breeze from the South is the name of that
one? Was it? Yes.
Well, you wrapped up the song and the sun came out. Yes. So
you're welcome.
You're welcome. Ben Furman, a lot of people associate a mandolin as a really rootsy American instrument, yet it seems to fit in with what you guys do awfully well.
Well, it is a really rootsy American folk instrument, but it's also kind of derived from the oud originally. When the Moors came over to Spain, they brought the oud with them. That became the lute, and then it just kind of evolved into the mandolin eventually.
This is a beautiful instrument here. Why don't you just strum a little bit of your mandolin here so we can enjoy the sounds of this just solo.
Oh, absolutely.
And to contrast that here with what Igor Huat is playing, his oud.
Yes.
Strum a few notes on the oud. Play a little bit for us solo. Are playing with some kind of plectrum there or pick that is what is that you're playing with?
It's basically if you imagine a guitar pick except much longer and a bit more flexible. You get that.
It looks like a nail file.
Good comparison. Yeah.
Now this is how many? Those are the widest strings that I've ever seen on a stringed instrument here.
Yes.
Down toward the nut here.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Yes. Usually we play this instrument melodically, so we don't play a lot of chords like a guitar. And just like I mentioned, we have 11 strings, but there's 6 string courses, so we have 6 notes that we have. And this one by itself is the bass note. All the other ones are in pairs, except for that bass note.
Very good.
Yes.
Did you start out playing this instrument, or did you?
I used to be a saxophone player. Came here to MSU to study the saxophone picked this up 4 years ago. So.
No kidding. let's move over to Ty Forker, who is I alluded to this beautiful percussion instrument. This is called what again?
A doombek.
A doombek. Why don't you play a few notes on the doombek there?
It's kind of an onomatopoeic kind of thing. It's a doom and a beck. Doom beck.
Are you really saying that's the origin of the name of the...
I don't know if it's an origin, but those are syllables that they use to teach rhythms on this drum in the Middle Eastern tradition. So it might be a chicken-egg situation.
Okay.
It sounds like what it does.
Did you play what was your first musical instrument? Do you play just percussion or what?
Well, I started playing percussion in high school and then, played electric guitar and things in rock bands in high school, and then really in college started getting into more world music. I played in a salsa band for a little while where I was playing conga drums, which is a different hand drum, a different technique, but then kind of ended up getting interested in these other things, and it ended up serving me well. And when I landed in this group and got to try out some of these things.
Igor, tell us about klezmer music. What distinguishes klezmer? Actually, Will Sokola, we're going to ask you that. What distinguishes klezmer music?
Klezmer music is specifically it's Jewish folk music, specifically Yiddish dance and celebratory music. And so the instrument that I'm playing klezmer music on, it's a little different from what you'd find in like a concert band or an orchestra. It's a clarinet in the key of C. And the music itself is you take a core melody and you decorate it in many different ways with these ornaments that come from a vocal tradition.
Okay. Well, we describe your music as fusion. We kind of have a little jazz and blues singer in the background, so we're enhancing the fusion nature of your music even more here today. But I'll tell you what, we're gonna have you guys play another song, if you will. What's up next?
This next tune is called Kahramana by the Syrian composer, singer called Farid al-Atrash, died in the early 70s, but he was really famous in the Arabic world.
Very good. It's Wissal on Current State on WKAR. With Saul here on Current State on WKAR. Igor, remind everybody where you're performing this weekend.
We will be here tomorrow on the main stage at the East Lansing Arts Festival from 11:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m.
Igor Huat, Mike List, Ty Forker, Will Sokola, and Ben Furman with Saul. Many, many thanks. That's our show for today. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joel Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks to Emmanuel Berry, Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, and Bill Richards. Also thanks to Drew Henderson and Luke Schwartzweller for engineering. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State, and Wissal is going to take us out. Wissal on WKAR. Have a great weekend at the East Lansing Arts Festival.